Welcome to Delmarva Public Radio's celebration of National Poetry Month, featuring literary biographies with Sue Ellen Thompson. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Today's lecture, Jack Gilbert, The Man Who Loved Women, is the fourth and last in our series of talks by Sue Ellen on the life and work of three great American poets: Robert Frost, Jane Kenyon, and Jack Gilbert. Sue Ellen, an important poet in her own right, has published 5 books of poetry, served as editor of the 2005 edition of the Autumn House Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry, and is the recipient of numerous awards, including nomination for the Pulitzer Prize. Her poems have been read a number of times on National Public Radio's The Writer's Almanac. All 4 of the programs in this series are produced by Delmarva Public Radio with the cooperation of the Talbot County Free Library in Easton, Maryland, and the Talbot County Arts Council, that funded the original lecture series on which this program is based. All of the lectures were recorded in the Frederick Douglass Room of the Talbot County Free Library before a live audience. Reading the poetry of Jack Gilbert, it is very difficult not to think of French author Albert Camus and his wonderful moral essay, The Myth of Sisyphus. Remember, Camus' essay was published in 1942, 2 years after the German occupation of France. It didn't become popular in the United States until the late 1950s. In Camus' essay, we find ourselves strangers in a world deprived of light and illusions. We are exiles here, and our exile is irrevocable, since we carry no memories of a lost homeland and no hope of a promised land. In Jack Gilbert's poem, it is difficult to speak of the night. Gilbert says that the voices in the dark of his poem, still keen of the divorce we are born into. I would suggest this divorce is the exile that Camus speaks of. If Robert Frost is a poet of the human voice, and Jane Kenyon, a creator of deeply personal lyric poems, perhaps we might say that Jack Gilbert is a writer of moral poetry. I don't mean moral here as the weighing of good and evil, right and wrong, but moral in the way the French use the term, as a lucid chronicler of the human condition. Gilbert's short declarative sentences lay bare the challenge of human existence and offer a call to delight in those unexpected moments of beauty in a world of suffering and alienation. Perhaps this explains why, at a poetry reading, a man in a black overcoat entered late and stood in the back of the room. After the reading, he walked down the queue of people lined up to speak to the poet and said to Gilbert, "I just wanted you to know your poetry saved my life." Then he turned and walked out. No comment, no further explanation. This is the power of Jack Gilbert's poetry. And now, Sue Ellen Thompson and Jack Gilbert, The Man Who Loved Women.
I'd heard the name Jack Gilbert, but I'm not sure I could have come up with the title to any of his poems until a friend introduced me to his work a few years ago. Gilbert's poems displayed the qualities I admire most: clarity of diction, strong imagery, and profound emotion conveyed with restraint. They sounded like the kind of poems I had been looking for as the editor of an anthology of contemporary American poetry back in 2005, when Gilbert was still very much alive. But somehow I'd overlooked him, and this, combined with the fact that he had died fairly recently, was enough to make me want to know his work better. The poems were not hard to find, but information about this elusive poet's life I discovered was hard to come by, and I wondered why. Jack Gilbert was born on February 17, 1925. He grew up during the Depression in the East Liberty District of Pittsburgh, one of four children who shared a mother but had different fathers. When Jack was 10, the only father he'd ever known fell out a window at the Owls Club, a place where men went to play cards and drink during Prohibition. The last Jack saw of him was a bloodstain on the pavement outside. As his mother grieved and struggled to support her family, young Jack learned to embrace both poverty and solitude. Linda Gregg, one of the most important women in Gilbert's adult life, described his childhood this way. They had 24 dead refrigerators in the basement. He didn't get along with anybody. He was small. He was a genius. Nevertheless, the child genius flunked out of high school. "I was fighting with the teachers all the time," he said. "Everybody accepted the fact that I was smart, but I wouldn't obey. I didn't believe what they said unless they could prove it." Understandably, this attitude did not go down well in a public high school of the 1940s. So he got a job, first as a Fuller Brush salesman and later as a steel worker and an exterminator. He had accompanied his uncle on fumigation jobs since his preteen years and later recalled that, quote, "the cyanide could knock you out with just one breath and in a matter of minutes you'd be dead," end quote. He pronounced it an eerie way to grow up, and it was. Gilbert described the Pittsburgh of his youth as a city of rusted iron, brutal winters, old trains at night, robber barons and steel mills, a Pittsburgh of the dark ages. Not a place for charm or decoration. But at the same time, he found the city with its three great rivers inspiring. "Every night, the sky looked enormous," he said. "It was a torrent of flames, a fire. The place Pittsburgh used to be had such scale. Everything was grand, heroic. Everything seemed to be gigantic." Although he left Pittsburgh in his early 20s, the city left its mark on him, as he wrote many years later in a poem called "The Spirit and the Soul." "It was Pittsburgh that lasted. The iron and fog and sooty brick houses, not Aunt Mince and Pearl, but the black and white winters with their girth and geological length of cold. Streets ripped apart by ice and emerging like wounded beasts when the snow finally left in April. Freight trains with their steam locomotives working at night. Summers the size of crusades." Gilbert had always been a voracious reader. At the age of 15, he discovered poetry in a local bookstore. He began reading Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, composing his own poems while walking the city streets. Although he'd never graduated from high school, he managed to get himself admitted to the University of Pittsburgh in 1945. Again, he flunked out, but not before forming one of the most important friendships of his life with another young poet, Gerald Stern. With Stern's encouragement, he became more serious about his writing. He dropped out of college and went to Paris, which was the logical destination for an aspiring writer in those days, but he was still a renegade. He and some of his friends decided they would buy up the titles for junked cars and then sell their gas rations on the black market. He was arrested for owning 28 automobiles and spent a night in jail. Soon afterward, he was on his way back to Pittsburgh, where he completed his BA in 1947. After graduation, he returned to Paris and worked briefly for the International Herald Tribune, an English-language newspaper. From there, he went to Italy, where he lived for several years and where he met the first great love of his life, Gianna Gelmetti. She was apparently a very beautiful woman, but there were problems. The Gelmettis were concerned about their daughter getting involved with a man who had no way of supporting her. It was her sister in the end who convinced Gilbert that he should break off the relationship and return to the United States. Gianna was made to have babies, the sister pointed out, and perhaps in his heart, Gilbert knew she was right. But many years later, he said, "That was an awful thing for me to do. I should have talked it over with Gianna." He left Italy in 1954, but like the city of Pittsburgh, she'd left her mark on him. Gilbert went first to New York and then to San Francisco, where the Beat Movement was well underway and the city was fast becoming known as the poetry capital of the world. Although he was never one of the Beat Poets, a group that included Allen Ginsberg, William S. Burroughs, Gary Snyder, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Gregory Corso, he became friends with Ginsberg and attended a Poetry as Magic workshop run by the California poet Jack Spicer, who screened would-be participants by asking them questions like, "What insect do you most resemble?" And if you had a chance to eliminate three political figures in the world, whom would you choose? Allen Ginsberg later recalled an early encounter with Gilbert. "We had an argument about meter. I leaned over and told him he was wrong. He was fresh from New York and of course thought he knew everything. He was affronted. We started arguing. Finally, he admitted I was right. And he took out a matchbook, scribbled his address on it, handed it to me and said, 'Come and see me.'" During this time, Gilbert lived, in his words, like a hippie without drugs. He was holed up in an abandoned house in the woods of Sausalito when Ginsberg showed up one day. "After we talked," Gilbert recalled, "he said he had something he wanted to show me. He got two pages out of his bag. I read them and then read them again. I looked at him and told them they were terrific. Those two pages, it turned out, were the beginning of Howl, the groundbreaking 1956 poem about gay sex, drugs, mental hospitals, and other convention-breaking themes, whose opening lines are among the few that most educated adults of a certain age can readily identify. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked." Ginsberg and the other Beat poets were writing their stream of consciousness poems about America, but Gilbert couldn't get Paris and Italy out of his mind. The San Francisco years were crucial ones. It was there he had a serious relationship with Laura Ulowitz, who was closely associated with the Beat poets and to whom Gilbert would one day dedicate his first book. He also studied photography with Ansel Adams and managed to get a master's degree in English from San Francisco State. But he never fully identified with the Beat movement. "I don't go in for freakish behavior or esoteric knowledge," he later told his friend Gordon Lish, who edited the literary magazine Genesis West and would later become the poetry editor at Knopf. Gilbert felt that the Beats were intellectually crude. He compared them to talented children who approach any new endeavor with tremendous enthusiasm, but with a limited attention span and no discipline. In Gilbert's opinion, they didn't show sufficient reverence for life and the work they were doing. Although still quite young, Gilbert was already setting himself apart from his contemporaries. "Usually my poems are caused by an impulse to communicate some part of my life rather than to please," he told Gordon Lish. "I don't want the reader to finish the poem and say how lovely it was. I want him to be disturbed, even miserable." At the age of 37, Jack Gilbert described himself as a kind of failure. "I don't really have an occupation," he said. "Most of the time I wander around looking at the trees or the concrete. I've never worked at a job more than 6 months at a time in my whole life. I've evaded all the adult responsibilities of marriage, a home, a car, a regular job, children, furniture, a bank account for emergencies." In fact, he disparaged poets who were trying to earn a living and support a family, most of whom did so by teaching. "Nice guys seldom write exciting poetry," he said. Easy for someone like Gilbert to say. He had learned at an early age to fend for himself and survive on very little. Then his life changed, thanks to Gianna Gelmetti's brother-in-law, Cleve Moffett, who was also a writer. As Gilbert was packing his things to leave Italy after ending his relationship with Gianna, Moffat tossed an application for the Yale Younger Poets Prize into Gilbert's suitcase. He had toyed with the idea of applying for the prize himself, but never did. Gilbert found the application when he got back to New York after his time in San Francisco, although he had submitted poems for publication only twice in the 20 years he had been writing. He filled it out and sent it in, along with the manuscript for his first book. Then he put the whole matter out of his mind. He was living in the East Village when Moffat knocked on his door one night. "They're looking all over for you," he told Gilbert. "They want to give you the Yale Prize." Gilbert didn't know how to respond to this news, so he took Moffat and two other friends out for milkshakes. The next day, he walked around the city trying to decide how he felt and what he should do. He ended up lying on his back under the Brooklyn Bridge all afternoon. When he got up, he called the Yale Committee and accepted the prize, which is given annually to an emerging poet under the age of 40 for his first book. Titled Views of Jeopardy, the book was published in 1962. Perhaps because the prize itself was so widely recognized, the book was praised by such established American poets as Stanley Kunitz, Denise Levertov, Theodore Rutke, and Muriel Rukeyser. But that paled in comparison to the public adoration Gilbert suddenly started receiving. Today, few college graduates, even English majors, can name a recent Yale Prize winner. But perhaps because it was the 1960s and the poet himself was movie star handsome, Gilbert became an overnight celebrity. He was photographed for Vogue and Glamour, after which women started stopping him on the street to ask for his autograph. The book was nominated for that year's Pulitzer Prize, and although it was up against stiff competition, including volumes by Robert Frost and William Carlos Williams, Gilbert admitted that the nomination made him happy in a shamelessly uncomplicated way. Soon he found himself reading to huge audiences, not the usual half dozen friends and relatives who show up for a first book poet's reading. The New York Times called him inescapably gifted, and the book began disappearing from library shelves. Gilbert's choice of an opening poem for this book was particularly interesting. I'll read In Dispraise of Poetry. When the king of Siam disliked a courtier, he gave him a beautiful white elephant. The miracle beast deserved such ritual that to care for him properly meant ruin. Yet to care for him improperly was worse. It appears the gift could not be refused. This is not the typical young poet's view of his art. Rather than basking in his own considerable gifts, Gilbert seems acutely aware of the burden that has been placed on him and his responsibility for its survival. No wonder he accused the beat poets of not having enough reverence for their art. "Fame is a lot of fun," Gilbert said later, "but it's not interesting. I loved being noticed and praised, but after about 6 months, I found it boring." Hanging out in literary circles and basking in his newfound glory were the equivalent, to paraphrase his own poem, of caring for his gift improperly. A $5,000 Guggenheim Fellowship in 1964 provided him with the opportunity for which he had been searching. He took the money and, along with Linda Gregg, a much younger poet he'd met while he was at San Francisco State, escaped to Greece. He lived with Gregg on the islands, primarily Santorini, with brief stays in Denmark and England for about 6 years. Their life there, the location for the legend of Atlantis, was a simple one. They rented a farmhouse in Monolithos on the flat side of the island opposite the main city, Thera, which was built on the high cliffs that were once the rim of a huge volcanic crater. I couldn't find much information about what they did during those years, probably because they didn't do that much. They ate, they slept, they walked and swam. Gilbert wrote the poems that would eventually become his second book, many of which chronicled the pleasures and difficulties of his relationship with Gregg. During the day, he wrote while she walked. Sometimes he fell asleep leaning against a wall, and when he woke up, it was dark and the stars were out. A meal might be no more than lentil soup, and sometimes they had to sleep fully dressed because the house had no heat. But their time was their own, and they could spend it as they wished. A very brief poem called Not Part of Literature describes the place perfectly. Monolithos was four fishermen huts along the water, a miniature villa closed for years, and our farmhouse 100 feet behind. Hot fields of barley, grapes, and tomatoes stretching away 3 flat miles to where the rest of the island used to be, where the few people live above the great cliffs, a low mountain to the south, and beyond that the earth filled with pictures of Atlantis. On our wrong side of the island were no people, cars, plumbing, or lights, the summer skies and Mediterranean constantly, no trees, me cleaning squid, Linda getting up from a chair. Place emerged as one of Gilbert's 3 great themes, the other two being the women he loved and the solitary practice of writing. This poem does more than describe where he lived. It embodies it. Plain diction, short sentence fragments, a poem with no trees, whose scope diminishes as the lines proceed, until all that is left at the end is the two of them, each enacting a single gesture. Me cleaning squid, Linda getting up from a chair. It's no surprise that he titles this poem Not Part of Literature. He's not trying to emulate the great writers or produce an enduring work of art. He is trying to capture the elemental nature of a place and its way of life. I mentioned earlier that while living in Greece, Gilbert also spent time in Denmark. It was while staying in Copenhagen that he wrote 2 pornographic novels with his friend Jean McLean, using the pen name Tor Kung. My Mother Taught Me, published in 1964, told the story of a young Swedish boy raised in an all-male orphanage who was then adopted by a family with an energetic foster mother and several enthusiastic daughters. You have to understand, Gilbert told an interviewer many years later, people were writing sex books back then, but no one was writing them well. So I wrote a good pornographic novel to show that it could be done. Then, just to drive his point home, he wrote a second one, imaginatively titled Forever Ecstasy. Neither contributed much to his reputation, although they no doubt provided an outlet for his romantic nature. Speaking of which, it was also in Denmark that Gilbert had an affair with a woman named Anna, who was married and had a baby. But her husband, a teacher, was so disgusted by pregnancy and nursing and everything associated with childbirth that he took his class on a trip out of town for the summer. This left the two lovers with a brief period when they could be alone together before Linda Gregg found out what was going on and reacted, understandably, with fury. But this interlude yielded one of Gilbert's most memorable poems, Trying to Have Something Left Over. There was a great tenderness to the sadness when I would go there. She knew how much I loved my wife and that we had no future. We were like casualties helping each other as we waited for the end. Now I wonder if we understood how happy those Danish afternoons were. Most of the time we did not talk. Often I took care of the baby while she did housework, changing him and making him laugh. I would say, Pittsburgh, softly each time before throwing him up, whisper Pittsburgh with my mouth against the tiny ear and throw him higher. Pittsburgh and happiness high up, the only way to leave even the smallest trace, so that all his life her son would feel gladness unaccountably when anyone spoke of the ruined city of steel in America, each time almost remembering something maybe important that got lost. Although this poem did not appear in a collection until 1994, we can again see in it some of the earmarks of his evolving style. Free verse in a single, solid-looking stanza, simple, straightforward diction, fragments rather than complete sentences, intense, barely contained emotion. There is no need to puzzle over what the poet is saying or how he feels. Abstract nouns, tenderness, sadness, happiness, gladness, are grounded in narrative detail. Him taking care of the baby, her doing chores around the house, him changing the baby's diapers and tossing him up in the air to make him laugh. It's not much, an afternoon in the life of two lovers, but it expands beyond the present moment to fill the baby's future. The speaker imprints his own childhood on his lover's child by whispering the entirely foreign and meaningless word Pittsburgh in his tiny ear, so that all his life her son would feel gladness unaccountably when anyone spoke of the ruined city of steel in America. I think these lines show the reverence for life that Gilbert felt the beat poets lacked. When he was interviewed many years later by the poet Chardon Yord, he compared writing a poem to being in an illicit relationship. "If you've ever experienced that," he said, "caring about a man or a woman in an illicit way, there's an emotional quality in that apartment that doesn't exist any other place in the world. That knowledge that this can't last, that you're hurting someone too much, the poem tries to capture this great tenderness." Gilbert returned to Greece and Linda Gregg, but their relationship began to fall apart. There is no doubt that he loved her, but perhaps their isolation from others and the conflicts that so often arise when two writers live together took their toll. It must have been particularly difficult for Gregg, who was almost 20 years younger and just starting out as a poet, to be living with someone who had won the Yale Prize and appeared in Vogue magazine. In his second book, Gilbert has a longish poem called All the Way From Here to There that ends like this. "What I remember best of the 4 years of watching in Greece and Denmark and London and Greece is Linda making lunch, her blondness and ivory coming up out of the blue Aegean. Linda walking with me daily across the island from Monolithos to Thera and back. That's what I remember most of death. The gentleness of us in that bare Greek Eden, the beauty as the marriage steadily failed." Perhaps this is a good point at which to address the subject of Gilbert and women, which has aroused some controversy, particularly since his death in 2012. He once said, "I relish the physical surface of a woman, but I am importantly haunted by the ghost inside." There is no doubt that he elevated women to an almost mythological status, that he saw in them something he would never fully understand. But nowadays, his obsession with them can come across as old-fashioned, if not anti-feminist, especially because he has been quoted as saying that a woman's essential mystery is a man's privilege to unlock. But given the times in which he lived and wrote, and the fact that he spent most of his life far away from American culture and the emerging feminist movement, Gilbert might be forgiven for his tendency to focus too much on the particulars of a woman's body. In fact, no other American poet has used the word nipples as often in his poems. But not everyone forgave him. Quote, "Gilbert is considered a great poet of Eros," the New Yorker poetry critic Dan Chiasson said, "I wish he had never gone near the subject." Well, he did, repeatedly. Let's take a look at two of the many poems Gilbert wrote about his 8 years with Linda Gregg. A Kind of World. Things that are themselves, waves, water, the rock, stone, the smell of her arms, stillness, windstorms, the long silence again, the well, the rabbit, heat, nipples and long thighs, her heavy, bright mane, plunging water flashing as she washes her body in the sun, perfect in whiteness, light going away every evening like some great importance, grapes outside the windows, Linda talking less and less, going down to the sea while she sleeps, standing in the cold water to my mouth just before morning, Linda saying late in the day, "We should eat now, or it would be too dark to wash the dishes." She going out quietly afterward to scream into the wind from the ocean, coming in, lighting the lamps. The ending of this poem recalls that of the one I read earlier describing their life on Santorini. But the subjects here have disappeared, leaving only the verbs. While Linda is ever present in the first 12 lines, her arms, her heavy, bright mane, and let's not forget her nipples and long thighs, the poem erases her as it proceeds. She talks less and less until finally her words are reduced to the most basic domestic instructions. We should eat now, or it will be too dark to wash the dishes. Her voice is lost in her scream, and her screams lost in the wind from the ocean. She returns to the house, but is, in a sense, no longer there. And what of the poet standing in cold water up to his mouth? It doesn't sound as though he thinks the distance that has opened up between them can be overcome. 30 years later, in his third book, Gilbert looked back on his relationship with Greg in a poem called Failing and Flying. Everyone forgets that Icarus also flew. It's the same when love comes to an end or the marriage fails and people say they knew it was a mistake, that everybody said it would never work, that she was old enough to know better. But anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Like being there by that summer ocean on the other side of the island while love was fading out of her, the stars burning so extravagantly those nights that anyone could tell you they would never last. Every morning she was asleep in my bed like a visitation, the gentleness in her like antelope standing in the dawn mist. Each afternoon, I watched her coming back through the hot, stony field after swimming, the sea light behind her, and the huge sky on the other side of that. Listen to her while we ate lunch. How can they say the marriage failed? Like the people who came back from Provence when it was Provence and said it was pretty, but the food was greasy. I believe Icarus was not failing as he fell, but just coming to the end of his triumph. Gilbert's distance from those years in Greece is conveyed by using the myth of Icarus, who in trying to escape the island of Crete flies too close to the sun and falls from the sky when the wings his father has made for him begin to melt, to talk about the failure of his relationship with Greg. Their love for each other hasn't disappeared entirely. In fact, he brings it back by recalling so vividly how she lay in their bed, the gentleness in her like antelope standing in dawn mist. What woman wouldn't want that said about her? And how she returned from swimming, the sea light behind her and the huge sky on the other side of that. It's as if he is saying, let's not focus on what we did badly, but on the fact that we flew, and for quite a long time. Their love, in other words, was not a failure. It was simply the end of their triumph. In any case, Gilbert fell in love again, this time with a Japanese sculptor named Michiko Nogami, whom he met in San Francisco after returning to the States from Greece in 1971. She was 21 years younger than Gilbert, and it seems that they were married either before or soon after moving to Japan, where Gilbert taught at Rikkyo University for several years. Then the U.S. State Department appointed him chief lecturer on American literature and sent him with his wife on a 15-country tour. Keep in mind that this was a poet who had still only published one book. Their marriage was apparently a happy one, but after only 11 years together, Michiko was diagnosed with cancer. Gilbert cared for her during her illness, and some of the poems for which he would be best remembered came from the period surrounding her death. Finding Something. I say moon is horses in the tempered dark because horse is the closest I can get to it. I sit on the terrace of this worn villa the king's telegrapher built on the mountain that looks down on a blue sea and the small white ferry that crosses slowly to the next island each noon. Michiko is dying in the house behind me, the long windows open so I can hear the faint sound she will make when she wants watermelon to suck, or so I can take her to a bucket in the corner of the high-ceilinged room, which is the best we can do for a chamber pot. She will lean against my leg as she sits so as not to fall over in her weakness. How strange and fine to get so near to it. The arches of her feet are like voices of children calling in the grove of lemon trees, where my heart is as helpless as crushed birds. Well, I'll be the first to admit that I find that opening image puzzling. Moon is horses in the tempered dark. I do understand that the poet is struggling to describe something he can't quite get his head around, a woman dying in her 30s. As is typical in so many of his poems, the scene is stripped down to its barest elements, the blue sea, the small white ferry, which recalls the ferry that carries the souls of the dead across the River Styx in Greek mythology, the faint sound of her need for his assistance. And he doesn't try to glamorize just what that assistance involves, but the most surprising and revealing line of all is, how strange and fine to get so near to it, so near to what Michiko is experiencing, so near to death itself. The poem ends with an image as elusive as the one with which it opened. The arches of her feet are like voices of children calling in the grove of lemon trees. What could be more innocent, more ethereal, further removed from the act of dying? Here again, we have Gilbert focused on a part of a woman's body. It's as if he is being forced to let go of her little by little until all he can hold on to is her feet. He is indeed finding something that by writing the poem, he doesn't have to let go of. I'll read two other poems about Michiko's death, an event that haunted Gilbert for many years. Married. I came back from the funeral and crawled around the apartment, crying hard, searching for my wife's hair. For 2 months, got them from the drain, from the vacuum cleaner, under the refrigerator, and off the clothes in the closet. But after other Japanese women came, there was no way to be sure which were hers, and I stopped. A year later, repotting Michiko's avocado, I find a long black hair tangled in the dirt. So, who were these other Japanese women? We don't know, but presumably Gilbert was searching to fill the void in his life, unsuccessfully, it would appear, because that long black hair tangled in the dirt of her avocado plant is clearly the one he was searching for all along. The tone and diction in this poem are both so spare and restrained, to quote an interview with Gilbert in Dark Horse magazine, that the poem's elegance almost slips by you. Indeed, even the shift from past tense, I came, I got them, I stopped, to the present tense, I find, at the end, is so subtle as to be barely noticed. The Sunday New York Times Book Review said that this poem, like any good Gilbert poem, is content simply to stare at you, not hostile, not friendly, just very focused. The second poem is called Michiko Dead. He managed, like somebody carrying a box that is too heavy, first with his arms underneath. When their strength gives out, he moves the hands forward, hooking them on the corners, pulling the weight against his chest. He moves his thumbs slightly when the fingers begin to tire, and it makes different muscles take over. Afterward, he carries it on his shoulder until the blood drains out of the arm that is stretched up to steady the box, and the arm goes numb. But now the man can hold underneath again so that he can go on without ever putting the box down. The extended metaphor for carrying the burden of his loss could not be clearer or more appropriate. His grief over Michiko's death, which is only referred to in the title, is the box he can never put down. Gilbert's second book, Monolithos, was published in 1982, the same year Michiko died, although most of the poems in it dated back further to his time in Greece with Linda Gregg. It had been 20 years since Gilbert won the Yale Prize, and he was now 57. The long-awaited volume of poems was well-received. It was nominated for the 1983 Pulitzer Prize, as well as for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the American Book Award. It won the Stanley Kunitz Prize and the American Poetry Review Prize, but 12 more years would elapse before he published another full-length book. Gilbert spent most of those years back in the U.S., where he did what poets have traditionally done to keep food on the table. He taught writing to college students at Syracuse University and elsewhere. Did he learn anything of value from teaching young people? An interviewer once asked him. No, he responded. Was he a good teacher? Excellent, he said. He also continued to write poems, but he was careful not to become what he thought of as an academic poet. I don't believe in poems as crossword puzzles, he told his friend Gordon Lish. Between 1982, when he returned to the States, and 1994, Gilbert worked on the poems that would appear in his third book, The Great Fires, published when he was 69. This is the book that contains the poems we've already seen about Michiko's death, but there are also poems about Linda Gregg and a long one dedicated to Gianna Gelmetti. Even Anna, the married woman in Denmark, makes an appearance or two, as does Pittsburgh, the city of his youth. A friend of mine in Connecticut who was part of a poetry group in Northampton, Massachusetts back in the 1980s that Gilbert more or less ran, said Gilbert, quote, didn't envy the wealthy. He said once that if he were rich, he wouldn't write, and his writing life was a kind of spiritual wealth not everyone is privileged to have, end quote. Northampton came as close as Gilbert got to having a home in his later years. He moved there in 1998 and rented a small studio apartment from his friend Henry Lyman. He was writer in residence at Smith College for a year and later served as Northampton's poet laureate. He spent some time living at Fort Juniper, the poet Robert Francis's house in Amherst, which had been turned into a writer's residence. In other words, he ended up doing what most poets do as they age, teaching a little, writing as much as they can. In 2004, Deborah Garrison, who was now the poetry editor at Knopf, sent the galleys of his fourth book, Refusing Heaven, to Alice Quinn, the poetry editor at The New Yorker. The magazine published 8 of Gilbert's poems over a 7-month period, giving his reputation a huge, and some would say long overdue, boost. When the book was published in 2005, it won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Refusing Heaven opens with a poem that has become a kind of rallying cry for Gilbert's fans. It's called A Brief for the Defense. Sorrow everywhere, slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they are starving somewhere else, with flies in their nostrils. But we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the mornings before summer dawn would not be made so fine. The Bengal tiger would not be fashioned so miraculously well. The poor women at the fountain are laughing together between the suffering they have known and the awfulness in their future, smiling and laughing while somebody in the village is very sick. There is laughter every day in the terrible streets of Calcutta, and the women laugh in the cages of Bombay. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation. We must risk delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. If the locomotive of the Lord runs us down, we should give thanks that the end had magnitude. We must admit there will be music despite everything. We stand at the prow again of a small ship anchored late at night in the tiny port looking over to the sleeping island. The waterfront is 3 shuttered cafes and 1 naked light burning. To hear the faint sound of oars in the silence as a rowboat comes slowly out and then goes back is truly worth all the years of sorrow that are to come. It's a brilliant title. He's defending joy, not in spite of suffering, but in the midst of it. There is more than one sentence here that could be carved on a gravestone or cross-stitched on a scatter pillow. If we deny our happiness, resist our satisfaction, we lessen the importance of their deprivation, or we must admit there will be music despite everything. Even though he uses several words to describe the joy without which he believes survival is impossible, it is delight that he settles on, that seems to express what he believes is most essential. He's not saying that we should take delight. He's telling us that we must risk it. In other words, it won't be easy in a world filled with cruelty and suffering to acknowledge the existence of joy. But if we deny it, our lives will be immeasurably reduced. And where can that delight be found? In the faint sound of oars and those three shuttered cafes and one naked light burning, surely an image he brought back with him from Greece. It is only by paying fierce attention to the world around us that we will be able to withstand all the years of sorrow that are to come. Gilbert was now 80 and beginning to look back on his life. "I'm so grateful," he told the Paris Review. "There's nothing I've wanted that I haven't had. Michiko dying, I regret terribly. And losing Linda's love, I regret equally. But I still feel grateful. It's almost unfair to have been as happy as I've been. But I was also very, very stubborn. I was determined to get what I wanted as a life." And for the most part, he did. But when he returned to Greece in 2004 with Linda Gregg, with whom he was still close friends and who wanted to finish writing a book of her own there, they discovered that the Greece they had known no longer existed. "Our Greece," he said, "was very quiet, peaceful, slow, friendly, farmers plowing, a couple of men in small boats, almost no electronics. A civilization that lasted 400 years is gone now." Perhaps it was his advancing age or having his poems appear in The New Yorker, but suddenly Jack Gilbert was on a roll. 4 years after Refusing Heaven was published, he had a fifth book titled The Dance Most of All. The poems are, in many cases, long looks backward to Pittsburgh and Greece and Michiko. My favorite looks all the way back to childhood. It's called Waiting and Finding. While he was in kindergarten, everybody wanted to play the tom-toms when it came time for that. You have to run in order to get there first, and he would not. So he always had a triangle. He does not remember how they played the tom-toms, but he sees clearly their Chinese look, red with dragons front and back and gold studs around that held the drum head tight. If you had a triangle, you didn't really make music. You mostly waited while the tambourines and tom-toms went on a long time until there was a signal for all triangle people to hit them the right way, usually once. Then it was tom-toms and waiting some more. But what he remembers is the sound of the triangle, a perfect shimmering sound that has lasted all his long life, fading out and coming again after a while, getting lost in the waiting for it to come again. Waiting, meaning without things, meaning love sometimes dying out, sometimes being taken away, meaning that often he lives silent in the middle of the world's music, waiting for the best to come again, beginning to hear the silence as he waits, beginning to like the silence, maybe too much. There you have it, Gilbert's life story. While other poets competed for the red and gold prizes, he held back, doing without the comforts of a middle-class life, watching love fade or being taken away. If any poet of his generation lived silent in the middle of the world's music, it was Gilbert, who barely published a book a decade while his fellow poets bashed away on their tambourines and tom-toms. But when the time came for him to hit his triangle, to make that perfect shimmering sound, he did it. In the long periods between books or teaching gigs or public appearances, he listened to the silence. And in the end, he preferred its music to any other. In 2006, Gilbert met up again with his old friend Gerald Stern. Stern was giving a reading in Amherst, Massachusetts, and there was a rumor that Gilbert might show up. Just before Stern got up to read, his 81-year-old friend walked in. According to a poet who was there that night and wrote about it later, Gilbert was frail, wispy, but sharp still, his white hair a kind of purer brilliance in the neon-lit room. He and Stern greeted one another warmly in the way of old men who can mutually appreciate one another's survival. Stern read the title poem from his book, The Red Coal, whose cover featured a photo of the two poets as young men in Paris. Gilbert might have achieved fame earlier, but it was Sterne who was widely acknowledged as a major American poet. Still, I find this story of the two men in their early 80s coming face to face after so many years and having taken such different routes to the same place extremely touching. I was living no more than 90 minutes away at the time and wish I had known about that reading. As Gilbert entered his 80s, he began to show signs of dementia. His old friend Henry Lyman took charge of his literary life and let Gilbert live in his garage apartment. The two had lunch together every day, usually bruschetta with smoked salmon. In 2009, it became clear that Gilbert needed around-the-clock care, and he was moved to a nursing home in Berkeley, California. He died there on November 13, 2012, surrounded by a group of Bay Area poets and friends. Linda Gregg was in New York at the time and was unable to get to his bedside, but he left her all his papers, letters, and poems. In the few full-length interviews Gilbert gave in his lifetime, most reveal a strong ego and contrarian nature. For example, here are his responses to questions from the Poetry Society of America. Question: Are you interested in poetry written in America but not in English? Gilbert: Not much. Question: What are your predictions for American poetry in the next century? Gilbert: A decline. You get the idea. But in a 2006 interview with NPR, he addressed his own mortality with the same unflinching honesty. I'm saying, sure, it's tough. We're all going to die, he said. There's a lot of injustice in the world. But what a bargain. I don't like the fact that my hair is thinning. I don't like the fact that two of the women I loved have died. But given that, what a wonderful privilege to be allowed to breathe, to see, to feel, to smell, to love. Or, as he put it in one of his own poems, it's the having, not the keeping, that is the treasure. Gilbert once said that the only thing better than being alone was to be seriously in love. But as he aged, it became more difficult for him to see himself as the charismatic figure he once was. When you get into your 60s, even your 50s, he said, and you look in the mirror, it's hard to think of yourself as romantic. Maybe so, but his love for women lived on in his poems long after his last relationship faded. Gianna Gelmetti, Linda Gregg, Anna from Denmark, Michiko Nogami, these were his muses and the true milestones in his life, not NEA grants or National Book Awards. When Gilbert's collected poems was published posthumously in 2012, it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, one of the few he might not have spurned. Its cover featured a woodcut of Gilbert done by Gianna Gelmetti, who had died just 2 years earlier at the age of 73. In his Paris Review interview, Gilbert asked, "Why do so many poets settle for so little? I don't understand why they're not greedy for what's inside them. When I read the poems that matter to me, it stuns me how much the presence of the heart in all its forms is endlessly available there." We might say the same about his own poems. Thank you.
So, Ellen, thank you for bringing us four brilliant lectures featuring Robert Frost, Jane Kenyon, and Jack Gilbert. And thanks to the Talbot County Free Library for hosting these lectures. And certainly a great thanks to our audience here in the Frederick Douglass Room, and to all of you for listening. This is the last of our four-part lecture series, Literary Biographies with Sue Ellen Thompson. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.